Perhaps your little weazened soul is plotting to turn against my father.
Not at all.
Yes, I'd be likely to believe you, wouldn't I? If ever a poor woman was sacrificed for policy to an unsavory marriage, it was myself. I could have picked a more proper man from the alleys and mud heaps of my native world.
Well, now, I'll tell you what, my lady. Perhaps you would enjoy returning to your native world, only to retain as a souvenir that portion of you with which I am best acquainted. I could have your tongue cut out first. And, he lolled his head calculatingly to one side, as a final improving touch to your beauty, your ears and the tip of your nose as well.
You wouldn't dare, you little pug dog. My father would pulverize your toy nation to meteoric dust. In fact, he might do it in any case if I told him you were treating with these barbarians.
Well, there's no need for threats. You are free to question the man yourself tonight. Meanwhile, madam, keep your wagging tongue still.
At your orders?
Here, take this, then, and keep still. The band was about her waist and the necklace around her neck. He pushed the knob himself and stepped back. The Comdora drew in her breath and held out her hand stiffly. She fingered the necklace gingerly and gasped again. The Comdor rubbed his hands with satisfaction and said, "You may wear it tonight, and I'll get you more. Now, keep still." The Comdora kept still. 7. Heim Twer fidgeted and shuffled his feet. He said, "What's twisting your face?" Obermallow lifted out of his brooding. "Is my face twisted? It's not meant so." "Something must have happened yesterday. I mean, besides that feast." With sudden conviction, "Mallow, there's trouble, isn't there?" "Trouble? No, quite the opposite. In fact, I'm in the position of throwing my full weight against a door and finding it ajar at the time. We're getting into this steel foundry too easily." "You suspect a trap?" "Oh, for Selden's sake, don't be melodramatic." Mallow swallowed his impatience and added conversationally, "It's just that the easy entrance means there will be nothing to see." "Atomic power, huh?" Twer ruminated. "I'll tell you, there's just about no evidence of any atomic power economy here in Corel, and it would be pretty hard to mask all signs of the widespread effects a fundamental technology such as atomics would have on everything." "Not if it was just starting up, Twer, and being applied to a war economy. You'd find it in the shipyards and the steel foundries only. So if we don't find it, then they haven't got it, or they're not showing it. Toss a coin or take a guess." Twer shook his head. "I wish I'd been with you yesterday." "I wish you had, too," said Mallow stonily. "I have no objection to moral support. Unfortunately, it was the Condor who set the terms of the meeting and not myself. And that, outside there, would seem to be the royal ground car to escort us to the foundry. Have you got the gadgets?" "All of them." 8. The foundry was large and bore the odor of decay which no amount of superficial repairs could quite erase. It was empty now, and in quite an unnatural state of quiet, as it played unaccustomed host to the Comdor and his court. Mallow had swung the steel sheet onto the two supports with a careless heave. He had taken the instrument held out to him by Twer and was gripping the leather handle inside its leaden sheath. "The instrument," he said, "is dangerous, but so is a buzzsaw. You just have to keep your fingers away." And as he spoke, he drew the muzzle slit swiftly down the length of the steel sheet, which quietly and instantly fell in two. There was a unanimous jump, and Mallow laughed. He picked up one of the halves and propped it against his knee. "You can adjust the cutting length accurately to a hundredth of an inch, and a 2-inch sheet will slit down the middle as easily as this thing did. If you've got the thickness exactly judged, you can place steel on a wooden table and split the metal without scratching the wood." And at each phrase, the atomic shear moved, and a gouged chunk of steel flew across the room. "That," he said, "is whittling with steel." He passed back the shear. "Or else you have the plane. Do you want to decrease the thickness of a sheet, smooth out an irregularity, remove corrosion? Watch." Thin, transparent foil flew off the other half of the original sheet in 6-inch swarths, then 8-inch, then 12. "Or drills? It's all the same principle." They were all crowded around now. It might have been a sleight-of-hand show, a corner magician, a vaudeville act made into high-pressure salesmanship. Comdor Asper fingered scraps of steel. High officials of the government tiptoed over each other's shoulders and whispered, while Mallow punched clean, beautiful round holes through an inch of hard steel at every touch of his atomic drill. "Just one more demonstration. Bring 2 short lengths of pipe, somebody." an honorable chamberlain of something or other, sprang to obedience in the general excitement and thought absorption, and stained his hands like any laborer. Mallow stood them upright and shaved the ends off with a single stroke of the shear, and then joined the pipes, fresh cut to fresh cut. And there was a single pipe. The new ends, with even atomic irregularities missing, formed one piece upon joining. Johannesson blocks at a stroke. Then Mallow looked up at his audience, stumbled at his first word, and stopped. There was the keen stirring of excitement in his chest, and the base of his stomach went tingly and cold. The Commodore's own bodyguard in the confusion had struggled to the front line, and Mallow, for the first time, was near enough to see their unfamiliar hand weapons in detail. They were atomic. There was no mistaking it. An explosive projectile weapon with a barrel like that was impossible. But that wasn't the big point. That wasn't the point at all. The butts of those weapons had, deeply etched upon them in worn gold plating, the spaceship and sun. The same spaceship and sun that was stamped on every one of the great volumes of the original encyclopedia that the Foundation had begun and not yet finished. The same spaceship and sun that had blazoned the banner of the Galactic Empire through millennia. Mallow talked through and around his thoughts. Test the pipe. It's one piece. Not perfect, naturally. The joining shouldn't be done by hand. There was no need of further legerdemain. It had gone over. Mallow was through. He had what he wanted. There was only one thing in his mind. The golden globe with its conventionalized rays and the oblique cigar shape that was a space vessel. The spaceship and sun of the Empire. The Empire. The words drilled. A century and a half had passed, but there was still the Empire somewhere deeper in the galaxy. And it was emerging again, out into the periphery. Mallow smiled. 9. The Far Star was 2 days out in space when Hober Mallow in his private quarters with Senior Lieutenant Drott handed him an envelope, a roll of microfilm, and a silvery spheroid. As of an hour from now, Lieutenant, you're acting captain of the Far Star until I return, or forever. Drott made a motion of standing, but Mallow waved him down imperiously. Quiet, and listen. The envelope contains the exact location of the planet to which you're to proceed. There, you will wait for me for 2 months. If before the tumor up the Foundation locates you, the microfilm is my report of the trip. If, however, and his voice was somber, I do not return at the end of 2 months and Foundation vessels do not locate you, proceed to the planet Terminus and hand in the time capsule as the report. Do you understand that? Yes, sir. At no time are you or any of the men to amplify in any single instance my official report. If we are questioned, sir? Then you know nothing. Yes, sir. The interview ended, and 50 minutes later, a lifeboat kicked lightly off the side of the Far Star. 10. Onum Bar was an old man, too old to be afraid. Since the last disturbances, he had lived alone on the fringes of the land with what books he had saved from the ruins. He had nothing he feared losing, least of all the worn remnant of his life, and so he faced the intruder without cringing. Your door was open, the stranger explained. His accent was clipped and harsh, and Barr did not fail to notice the strange blue steel hand weapon at his hip. In the half-gloom of the small room, Barr saw the glow of a force shield surrounding the man. He said wearily, There is no reason to keep it closed. Do you wish anything of me? Yes. The stranger remained standing in the center of the room. He was large, both in height and bulk. Yours is the only house about here.
It is a desolate place, agreed Barr. There is a town to the east. I can show you the way.
In a while. May I sit?
If the chairs will hold you, said the old man gravely. They were old, too, relics of a better youth.
The stranger said, My name is Hober Mallow. I come from a far province. Barr nodded and smiled.
Your tongue convicted you of that long ago. I am Onum Barr of Siwenna, and once patrician of the Empire.
Then this is Siwenna. I had only old maps to guide me.
They would have to be old indeed for star positions to be misplaced.
Barr sat quite still, while the other's eyes drifted away into a reverie. He noticed that the atomic force shield had vanished from about the man and admitted dryly to himself that his person no longer seemed formidable to strangers, or even for good or for evil to his enemies. He said,
My house is poor and my resources few. You may share what I have if your stomach can endure black bread and dried corn.
Mallow shook his head. No, I have eaten. And I can't stay. All I need are the directions to the center of government.
That is easily enough done, and poor though I am, deprives me of nothing. Do you mean the capital of the planet or of the imperial sector? The younger man's eyes narrowed. Aren't the two identical? Isn't this Siwenna? The old patrician nodded slowly. Siwenna, yes, but Siwenna is no longer capital of the Normannic sector. Your old map has misled you after all. The stars may not change even in centuries, but political boundaries are all too fluid. That's too bad. In fact, that's very bad. Is the new capital far off? It's on Orsha II, 20 parsecs off. Your map will direct you. How old is it? 150 years. That old? The old man sighed. History has been crowded since. Do you know any of it? Mallow shook his head slowly. Barr said, You're fortunate. It has been an evil time for the provinces, but for the reign of Stanil VI, and he died 50 years ago. Since that time, rebellion and ruin, ruin and rebellion. Barr wondered if he were growing garrulous. It was a lonely life out here, and he had so little chance to talk to men. Mallow said with sudden sharpness, Ruin, huh? You sound as if the province were impoverished. Perhaps not on an absolute scale. The physical resources of 25 first-rank planets take a long time to use up. Compared to the wealth of the last century, though, we have gone a long way downhill, and there is no sign of turning, not yet. Why are you so interested in all this, young man? You are all alive, and your eyes shine. The trader came near enough to blushing, as the faded eyes seemed to look too deep into his and smile at what they saw. He said, Now look here, I'm a trader out there, out toward the rim of the galaxy. I've located some old maps, and I'm out to open new markets. Naturally, talk of impoverished provinces disturbs me. You can't get money out of a world unless money's there to be got. Now, how's Siwenna, for instance? The old man leaned forward. I cannot say. It will do even yet, perhaps. But you, a trader, you look more like a fighting man. You hold your hand near your gun, and there is a scar on your jawbone. Mallow jerked his head. There isn't much law out there where I come from. Fighting and scars are part of a trader's overhead. But fighting is only useful when there's money at the end, and if I can get it without, so much the sweeter. Now, will I find enough money here to make it worth the fighting? I take it I can find the fighting easily enough. Easily enough, agreed Barr. You could join Wiscard's remnants in the Red Stars. I don't know, though, if you'd call that fighting or piracy. Or you could join our present gracious viceroy, gracious by right of murder, pillage, rapine, and the word of a boy emperor, since rightfully assassinated. The patrician's thin cheeks reddened, his eyes closed, and then opened bird-bright. You don't sound very friendly to the viceroy, Patrician Barr, said Mallow. What if I'm one of his spies? What if you are? Said Barr bitterly. What can you take? Gestured a withered arm at the bare interior of the decaying mansion. Your life. It would leave me easily enough. It has been with me 5 years too long. But you are not one of the viceroy's men. If you were, perhaps even now, instinctive self-preservation would keep my mouth closed. How do you know? The old man laughed. You seem suspicious. Come, I'll wager you think I'm trying to trap you into denouncing the government. No, no, I am past politics. Past politics? Is a man ever past that? The words you used to describe the viceroy, what were they? Murder, pillage, all that? You didn't sound objective. Not exactly. Not as if you were past politics. The old man shrugged. Memories sting when they come suddenly. Listen, judge for yourself. When Siwenna was the provincial capital, I was a patrician and a member of the provincial senate. My family was an old and honored one. One of my great-grandfathers had been... Oh, no, never mind that. Past glories are poor feeding. I take it, said Mallow, there was a civil war or a revolution. Barr's face darkened. Civil wars are chronic in these degenerate days, but Siwenna had kept apart. Under Stanil VI, it had almost achieved its ancient prosperity. But weak emperors followed, and weak emperors mean strong viceroys. And our last viceroy, the same Wiscard whose remnants still prey on the commerce among the Red Stars, aimed at the imperial purple. He wasn't the first to aim, and if he had succeeded, he wouldn't have been the first to succeed. But he failed, for when the emperor's admiral approached the province at the head of a fleet, Siwenna itself rebelled against its rebel viceroy. He stopped sadly. Mallow found himself tense on the edge of his seat and relaxed slowly. Please continue, sir. Thank you, said Barr wearily. It's kind of you to humor an old man. They rebelled, or I should say we rebelled, for I was one of the minor leaders. Wiscard left Siwenna, barely ahead of us, and the planet, and with it the province, were thrown open to the admiral with every gesture of loyalty to the emperor. Why we did this, I'm not sure. Maybe we felt loyal to the symbol, if not to the person, of the emperor, a cruel and vicious child. Maybe we feared the horrors of a siege.
Well, urged Mallow gently.
Well, came the grim retort, that didn't suit the admiral. He wanted the glory of conquering a rebellious province, and his men wanted the loot such conquest would involve. So while the people were still gathered in every large city, cheering the emperor and his admiral, he occupied all armed centers and then ordered the population put to the atom blast.
On what pretext?
On the pretext that they had rebelled against their viceroy, the emperor's anointed, and the admiral became the new viceroy by virtue of 1 month of massacre, pillage, and complete horror. I had 6 sons. 5 died variously. I had a daughter. I hope she died eventually. I escaped because I was old. I came here, too old to cause even our viceroy worry.
He bent his gray head.
They left me nothing because I had helped drive out a rebellious governor and deprived an admiral of his glory.
Mallow sat silent and waited. Then, what of your 6th son? He asked softly.
Eh? Bear smiled acidly. He is safe, for he has joined the admiral as a common soldier under an assumed name. He is a gunner in the viceroy's personal fleet. Oh, no, I see your eyes. He is not an unnatural son. He visits me when he can and gives me what he can. He keeps me alive. And someday, our great and glorious viceroy will grovel to his death, and it will be my son who will be his executioner.
And you tell this to a stranger? You endanger your son?
Now I help him by introducing a new enemy. And were I a friend of the viceroy, as I am his enemy, I would tell him to string outer space with ships clear to the rim of the galaxy.
There are no ships there?
Did you find any? Did any space guards question your entry? With ships few enough and the bordering provinces filled with their share of intrigue and iniquity, none can be spared to guard the barbarian outer suns. No danger ever threatened us from the broken edge of the galaxy until you came.
I'm no danger.
There will be more after you.
Mallow shook his head slowly. I'm not sure I understand you.
Listen. There was a feverish edge to the old man's voice. I knew you when you entered. You have a force shield about your body, or had when I first saw you.
Doubtful silence. Then, yes, I had.
Good. That was a flaw, but you didn't know that. There are some things I know. It's out of fashion in these decaying times to be a scholar. Events race and flash past, and who cannot fight the tide with atom blast in hand is swept away as I was. But I was a scholar, and I know that in all the history of atomics, no portable force shield was ever invented. We have force shields, huge, lumbering powerhouses that will protect a city or even a ship, but not one single man.
Ah? Mallow's underlip thrust out. And what do you deduce from that?
There have been stories percolating through space. They travel strange paths and become distorted with every parsec. But when I was young, there was a small ship of strange men who did not know our customs and could not tell where they came from. They talked of magicians at the edge of the galaxy, magicians who glowed in the darkness, who flew unaided through the air, and whom weapons would not touch. We laughed. I laughed, too. I forgot it till today. But you glow in the darkness, and I don't think my blaster, if I had one, would hurt you. Tell me, can you fly through air as you sit there now?
Mallow said calmly. I can make nothing of all this.
Barr smiled. I am content with the answer. I do not examine my guests. But if there are magicians, if you are one of them, there may someday be a great influx of them, or you. Perhaps that would be well. Maybe we need new blood.
He muttered soundlessly to himself, then slowly,
but it works the other way, too. Our new viceroy also dreams, as did our old Wiscard.
Also after the emperor's crown?
Barr nodded. My son hears tales. In the viceroy's personal entourage, one could scarcely help it. And he tells me of them. Our new viceroy would not refuse the crown if offered, but he guards his line of retreat. There are stories that, failing imperial heights, he plans to carve out a new empire in the barbarian hinterland. It is said, but I don't vouch for this, that he has already given one of his daughters as wife to a kinglet somewhere in the uncharted periphery. If one listened to every story,
I know.
There are many more. I'm old and I babble nonsense. But what do you say?
And those sharp old eyes peered deep. The trader considered. I say nothing, but I'd like to ask something. Does Siwena have atomic power? No, wait, I know that it possesses the knowledge of atomics. I mean, do they have power generators intact, or did the recent sack destroy them?
Destroy them? Oh, no. Half a planet would be wiped out before the smallest power station would be touched. They are irreplaceable, and the suppliers of the strength of the fleet,
almost proudly,
we have the largest and best on this side of Trantor itself.
Then what would I do first if I wanted to see these generators?
Nothing, replied Barr decisively. You couldn't approach any military center without being shot down instantly. Neither could anyone. Siena is still deprived of civic rights.
You mean all the power stations are under the military?
No, there are the small city stations, the ones supplying power for heating and lighting homes, powering vehicles and so forth. Those are almost as bad. They're controlled by the tech men.
Who are they?
A specialized group which supervises the power plants. The honor is hereditary, the young ones being brought up in the profession as apprentices. Strict sense of duty, honor, and all that. No one but a tech man could enter a station.
I see.
I don't say, though, added Barr, that there aren't cases where tech men haven't been bribed. In days when we have 9 emperors in 50 years and 7 of these are assassinated, when every space captain aspires to the usurpation of a viceroyship and every viceroy to the Imperium, I suppose even a tech man can fall prey to money. But it would require a good deal, and I have none. Have you?
Money? No. But does one always bribe with money?
What else, when money buys all else?
There is quite enough that money won't buy. And now, if you'll tell me the nearest city, one of the stations, and how best to get there, I'll thank you.
Wait, Barr held out his thin hands. Where do you rush? You come here, but I ask no questions. In the city, where the inhabitants are still called rebels, you would be challenged by the first soldier or guard who heard your accent and saw your clothes.
He rose, and from an obscure corner of an old chest brought out a booklet.
My passport, forged. I escaped with it.
He placed it in Mallow's hand and folded the fingers over it.
The description doesn't fit, but if you flourish it, the chances are many to one they will not look closely.
But you'll be left without one.
The old exile shrugged cynically. What of it? And a further caution. Curb your tongue. Your accent is barbarous, your idioms peculiar, and every once in a while you deliver yourself of the most astounding archaisms. The less you speak, the less suspicion you will draw upon yourself. Now, I'll tell you how to get to the city.
5 minutes later, Mallow was gone. He returned but once for a moment to the old patrician's house before leaving it entirely, however. And when Onum Barr stepped into his little garden early the next morning, he found a box at his feet. It contained provisions, concentrated provisions such as one would find aboard ship, and alien in taste and preparation. But they were good, and last long. 11. The tech man was short, and his skin glistened with well-kept plumpness. His hair was a fringe, and his skull shone through pinkly. The rings on his fingers were thick and heavy, his clothes were scented, and he was the first man Mallow had met on the planet who hadn't looked hungry. The tech man's lips pursed peevishly.
Now, my man, quickly. I have things of great importance waiting for me. You seem a stranger.
He seemed to evaluate Mallow's definitely un-Siwanese costume, and his eyelids were heavy with suspicion. I am not of the neighborhood, said Mallow calmly, but the matter is irrelevant. I have had the honor to send you a little gift yesterday. The tech man's nose lifted.
I received it. An interesting gigaw. I may have use for it on occasion.
I have other and more interesting gifts, quite out of the gigaw stage.
Oh?
The tech man's voice lingered thoughtfully over the monosyllable.
I think I already see the course of the interview. It has happened before. You're going to give me some trifle or other, a few credits, perhaps a cloak, second-rate jewelry, anything your little soul may think sufficient to corrupt the tech man.
His lower lip puffed out belligerently.
And I know what you wish in exchange. There have been others to suffice with the same bright idea. You wish to be adopted into our clan. You wish to be taught the mysteries of atomics and the care of the machines. You think because you dogs of Siena, and probably your strangerhood is assumed for safety's sake, are being daily punished for your rebellion, that you can escape what you deserve by throwing over yourselves the privileges and protections of the tech man's guild.
Mallow would have spoken, but the tech man raised himself into a sudden roar.
And now leave before I report your name to the protector of the city. Do you think that I would betray the trust? The Siwanese traitors that preceded me, perhaps, but you deal with a different breed now. By galaxy, I marvel that I do not kill you myself at this moment with my bare hands.
Mallow smiled to himself. The entire speech was patently artificial in tone and content, so that all the dignified indignation degenerated into uninspired farce. The traitor glanced humorously at the 2 flabby hands that had been named as his possible executioners then and there, and said,
Your wisdom, you are wrong on 3 counts. First,
I am not a creature of the viceroy come to test your loyalty. Second, my gift is something the emperor himself in all his splendor does not and will never possess. Third, what I wish in return is very little, a nothing, a mere breath.
So you say, he descended into heavy sarcasm. Come, what is this imperial donation that your godlike power wishes to bestow upon me? Something the emperor doesn't have, eh?
He broke into a sharp squawk of derision. Mallow rose and pushed the chair aside. I have waited 3 days to see you, your wisdom, but the display will take only 3 seconds. If you will just draw that blaster whose butt I see very near your hand,
eh?
And shoot me, I will be obliged.
What?
If I am killed, you can tell the police I tried to bribe you into betraying guild secrets. You'll receive high praise. If I am not killed, you may have my shield. For the first time, the tech man became aware of the dimly white illumination that hovered closely about his visitor, as though he had been dipped in pearl dust. His blaster raised to the level, and with eyes asquint in wonder and suspicion, he closed contact. The molecules of air caught in the sudden surge of atomic disruption tore into glowing, burning ions and marked out the blinding thin line that struck at Mallow's heart and splashed. While Mallow's look of patience never changed, the atomic forces that tore at him consumed themselves against that fragile, pearly illumination and crashed back to die in midair. The tech man's blaster dropped to the floor with an unnoticed crash. Mallow said, Does the Emperor have a personal force shield? You can have one. The tech man stuttered,
Are you a tech man?
No.
Then where did you get that?
What do you care? Mallow was coolly contemptuous. Do you want it? A thin, knobbed chain fell upon the desk. There it is. The tech man snatched it up and fingered it nervously.
Is this complete?
Complete.
Where's the power?
Mallow's finger fell upon the largest knob, dull in its leaden case. The tech man looked up, and his face was congested with blood.
Sir, I am a tech man, senior grade. I have 20 years behind me as a supervisor, and I studied under the great Blair at the University of Trantor. If you have the infernal charlatanry to tell me that a small container the size of a walnut blasted holes an atomic generator, I'll have you before the protector in 3 seconds.
Explain it yourself, then, if you can. I say it's complete. The tech man's flush faded slowly as he bound the chain about his waist, and following Mallow's gesture, pushed the knob. The radiance that surrounded him shone into dim relief. His blaster lifted, then hesitated. Slowly he adjusted it to an almost burnless minimum. And then, convulsively, he closed circuit, and the atomic fire dashed against his hand harmlessly. He whirled.
And what if I shoot you now and keep the shield?
Try, said Mallow. Do you think I gave you my only sample? And he, too, was solidly encased in light. The tech man giggled nervously. The blaster clattered onto the desk. He said,
And what is this mere nothing, this breath, that you wish in return?
I want to see your generators.
You realize that that is forbidden. It would mean ejection into space for both of us.
I don't want to touch them or have anything to do with them. I want to see them from a distance.
If not,
you have your shield, but I have other things. For one thing, a blaster especially designed to pierce that shield. The tech man's eyes shifted.
Come with me.
12. The tech man's home was a small two-story affair on the outskirts of the huge cubiform windowless affair that dominated the center of the city. Mallow passed from one to the other through an underground passage and found himself in the silent, ozone-tinged atmosphere of the powerhouse. For 15 minutes, he followed his guide and said nothing. His eyes missed nothing. His fingers touched nothing. And then the tech man said in strangled tones,
Have you had enough? I couldn't trust my underlings in this case.
Could you ever? Asked Mallow ironically. I've had enough. They were back in the office, and Mallow said thoughtfully, And all those generators are in your hands?
Every one,
said the tech man, with more than a touch of complacency. And you keep them running and in order?
Right.
And if they break down? The tech man shook his head indignantly.
They don't break down. They never break down. They were built for eternity.
Eternity is a long time. Just suppose
it is unscientific to suppose meaningless cases.
All right. Suppose I were to blast a vital part into nothingness. I suppose the machines aren't immune to atomic forces. Suppose I fuse a vital connection or smash a quartz D-tube.
Well then, shouted the tech man furiously, you would be killed.
Yes, I know that. Mallow was shouting, too. But what about the generator? Could you repair it?
Sir, The tech man howled his words. You have had a fair return. You've had what you asked for. Now get out. I owe you nothing more.
Mallow bowed with a satiric respect and left. 2 days later, he was back at the base where the Far Star waited to return with him to the planet Terminus. And 2 days later, the tech man's shield went dead, and for all his puzzling and cursing, never glowed again.
13. Mallow relaxed for almost the first time in 6 months. He was on his back in the sunroom of his new house, stripped to the skin. His great brown arms were thrown up and out, and the muscles tautened into a stretch, then faded into repose. The man beside him placed a cigar between Mallow's teeth and lit it. He champed on one of his own and said,
You must be overworked. Maybe you need a long rest.
Maybe I do, Jail. But I'd rather rest in a council seat, because I'm going to have that seat, and you're going to help me.
Anchor Jail raised his eyebrows and said, How did I get into this?
You got in, obviously. Firstly, you're an old dog of a politico. Secondly, you were booted out of your cabinet seat by Geraint Sutt, the same fellow who'd rather lose an eyeball than see me in the council. You don't think much of my chances, do you?
Not much, agreed the ex-minister of education. You're a Smyrnian.
That's no legal bar. I've had a lay education.
Well, come now. Since when does prejudice follow any law but its own? Now, how about your own man, this Chaim Twer? What does he say?
He spoke about running me for council almost a year ago, replied Mallow easily, but I've outgrown him.
He couldn't have pulled it off in any case. Not enough depth. He's loud and forceful, but that's only an expression of nuisance value. I'm off to put over a real coup. I need you.
Geraint Sutt is the cleverest politician on the planet, and he'll be against you. I don't claim to be able to outsmart him, and don't think he doesn't fight hard and dirty.
I've got money.
That helps, but it takes a lot to buy off prejudice, you dirty Smyrnian.
I'll have a lot.
Well, I'll look into the matter. But don't ever you crawl up on your hind legs and bleat that I encouraged you in the matter.
Who's that?
Mallow pulled the corners of his mouth down and said, Geraint Sutt himself, I think. He's early, and I can understand it. I've been dodging him for a month. Look, Jail, get into the next room and turn the speaker on low. I want you to listen.
He helped the council member out of the room with a shove of his bare foot, then scrambled up and into a silk robe. The synthetic sunlight faded to normal power.
The secretary to the mayor entered stiffly, while the solemn major domo tiptoed the door shut behind him.
Mallow fastened his belt and said, Take a choice of chairs, Sutt.
Sutt barely cracked a flicking smile. The chair he chose was comfortable, but he did not relax into it. From its edge, he said, If you'll state your terms to begin with, we'll get down to business.
What terms?
You wish to be coaxed? Well then, what, for instance, did you do at Corel? Your report was incomplete.
I gave it to you months ago. You were satisfied then.
Yes. Sutt rubbed his forehead thoughtfully with one finger. But since then, your activities have been significant. We know a good deal of what you're doing, Mallow. We know exactly how many factories you're putting up, in what a hurry you're doing it, and how much it's costing you. And there's this palace you have. He gazed about him with a cold lack of appreciation, which sets you back considerably more than my annual salary. And a swath you've been cutting, a very considerable and expensive swath, through the upper layers of Foundation society.
So, beyond proving that you employ capable spies, what does it show?
It shows you have money you didn't have a year ago, and that can show anything. For instance, that a good deal went on at Corel that we know nothing of. Where are you getting your money?
This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.
My dear Sutt, you can't really expect me to tell you.
I don't.
I didn't think you did. That's why I'm going to tell you. It's straight from the treasure chests of the Commodore of Corel.
Sutt blinked.
Mallow smiled and continued, Unfortunately for you, the money is quite legitimate. I'm a master trader, and the money I received was a quantity of wrought iron and chromite in exchange for a number of trinkets I was able to supply him with. 50% of the profit is mine by hide-bound contract with the Foundation. The other half goes to the government at the end of the year when all good citizens pay their income tax.
There was no mention of any trade agreement in your report.
Nor was there any mention of what I had for breakfast that day, or the name of my current mistress, or any other irrelevant detail.
Mallow's smile was fading into a sneer.
I was sent, to quote yourself, to keep my eyes open. They were never shut. You wanted to find out what happened to the captured Foundation merchant ships. I never saw or heard of them. You wanted to find out if Corel had atomic power. My report tells of atomic blasters in the possession of the Commodore's private bodyguard. I saw no other signs. And the blasters I did see are relics of the old empire, and maybe showpieces that do not work, for all my knowledge. So far, I followed orders, but beyond that, I was, and still am, a free agent. According to the laws of the Foundation, a master trader may open whatever new markets he can and receive therefrom his due half of the profits. What are your objections? I don't see them. Sut bent his eyes carefully towards the wall and spoke with a difficult lack of anger. It is the general custom of all traders to advance the religion with their trade. I adhere to law and not to custom. There are times when custom can be the higher law. Then appeal to the courts. Sut raised somber eyes which seemed to retreat into their sockets. You're a Smyrnian after all. It seems naturalization and education can't wipe out the taint in the blood. Listen and try to understand just the same. This goes beyond money or markets. We have the science of the great Harry Seldon to prove that upon us depends the future empire of the galaxy, and from the course that leads to that imperium we cannot turn. The religion we have is our all-important instrument towards that end. With it, we have brought the four kingdoms under our control, even at the moment when they would have crushed us. It's the most potent device known with which to control men and worlds. The primary reason for the development of trade and traders was to introduce and spread this religion more quickly, and to ensure that the introduction of new techniques and a new economy would be subject to our thorough and intimate control. He paused for breath, and Mallow interjected quietly, I know the theory. I understand it entirely. Do you? It is more than I expected. Then you see, of course, that your attempted trade for its own sake, at mass production of worthless gadgets which can only affect a world's economy superficially, at the subversion of interstellar policy to the god of profits, at the divorce of atomic power from our controlling religion, can only end with the overthrow and complete negation of the policy that has worked successfully for a century. And time enough, too, said Mallow indifferently, for a policy outdated, dangerous, and impossible. However well your religion has succeeded in the four kingdoms, scarcely another world in the periphery has accepted it. At the time we seized control of the kingdoms, there were a sufficient number of exiles, Galaxy knows, to spread the story of how Salvor Hardin used the priesthood and the superstition of the people to overthrow the independence and power of the secular monarchs. And if that wasn't enough, the case of Asconi 2 decades back made it plain enough. There isn't a ruler in the periphery now that wouldn't sooner cut his own throat than let a priest of the Foundation enter the territory. I don't propose to force Corel or any other world to accept something I know they don't want. No, Sut. If atomic power makes them dangerous, a sincere friendship through trade will be many times better than an insecure overlordship based on the hated supremacy of a foreign spiritual power, which, once it weakens ever so slightly, can only fall entirely and leave nothing substantial behind except an immortal fear and hate. Sut said cynically, very nicely put. So to get back to the original point of discussion, what are your terms? What do you require to exchange your ideas for mine? You think my convictions are for sale? Why not? Came the cold response. Isn't that your business, buying and selling? Only at a profit, said Mallow, unoffended. Can you offer me more than I'm getting as is? You could have 3/4 of your trade profits rather than half. Mallow laughed shortly. A fine offer. The whole of the trade on your terms would fall far below a 1/10 share on mine. Try harder than that. You can have a council seat. I'll have that anyway, without and despite you. With a sudden movement, Sut clenched his fist. You could also save yourself a prison term of 20 years if I have my way. Count the profit in that. No profit at all, unless you can fulfill such a threat. It's trial for murder. Whose murder? Asked Mallow contemptuously. Sut's voice was harsh now, though no louder than before. The murder of an Anacreonian priest in the service of the Foundation. Is that so now? And what's your evidence? The secretary to the mayor leaned forward. Mallow, I'm not bluffing. The preliminaries are over. I have only to sign one final paper, and the case of the Foundation versus Hober Mallow, master trader, is begun. You abandoned a subject of the Foundation to torture and death at the hands of an alien mob, Mallow, and you have only 5 seconds to prevent the punishment, do you? For myself, I'd rather you decided to bluff it out. You'd be safer as a destroyed enemy than as a doubtfully converted friend. Mallow said solemnly, you have your wish. Good. And the secretary smiled savagely. It was the mayor who wished the preliminary attempted compromise, not I. Witness that I did not try too hard. The door opened before him, and he left. Mallow looked up as Anchor Jail re-entered the room. Mallow said, did you hear him? The politician flopped to the floor. I never heard him as angry as that since I've known the snake. All right, what do you make of it? Well, I'll tell you. A foreign policy of domination through spiritual means is his ID fix, but it's my notion that his ultimate aims aren't spiritual. I was fired out of the cabinet for arguing on the same issue, as I needn't tell you. You needn't. And what are those unspiritual aims, according to your notion? Jael grew serious. Well, he's not stupid, so he must see the bankruptcy of our religious policy, which has hardly made a single conquest for us in 70 years. He's obviously using it for purposes of his own. Now, any dogma, primarily based on faith and emotionalism, is a dangerous weapon to use on others, since it is almost impossible to guarantee that the weapon will never be turned on the user. For 100 years now, we've supported a ritual and mythology that is becoming more and more venerable, traditional, and immovable. In some ways, it isn't under our control anymore.
In what ways? Demanded Mallow.
Don't stop. I want your thoughts. Well, suppose one man, one ambitious man, uses the force of religion against us rather than for us.
You mean Sut?
You're right. I mean Sut. Listen, man, if he could mobilize the various hierarchies on the subject planets against the Foundation in the name of orthodoxy, what chance would we stand? By planting himself at the head of the standards of the pious, he could make war on heresy, as represented by you, for instance, and make himself king eventually. After all, it was Hardin who said, "An atom blaster is a good weapon, but it can point both ways."
Mallow slapped his bare thigh.
"All right, Jael, then get me in that council, and I'll fight him."
Jael paused, then said significantly,
"Maybe not. What was all that about having a priest lynch? It isn't true, is it?"
"It's true enough," Mallow said carelessly.
Jael whistled.
"Has he definite proof?"
"He should have."
Mallow hesitated, then added, "Chaim Twer was his man from the beginning, though neither of them knew that I knew that. And Chaim Twer was an eyewitness."
Jael shook his head.
"Uh-oh, that's bad."
"Bad? What's bad about it?"
"That priest was illegally upon the planet by the Foundation's own laws. He was obviously used by the Corellian government as a bait, whether involuntary or not. By all the laws of common sense, I had no choice but one action, and that action was strictly within the law. If he brings me to trial, he'll do nothing but make a prime fool of himself."
And Jael shook his head again. "No, Mallow, you've missed it. I told you he played dirty. He's not out to convict you. He knows he can't do that. But he is out to ruin your standing with the people. You heard what he said. Custom is higher than law at times. You could walk out of the trial scot-free. But if the people think you threw a priest to the dogs, your popularity is gone. They'll admit you did the legal thing, even the sensible thing. But just the same, you'll have been in their eyes a cowardly dog, an unfeeling brute, a hard-hearted monster. And you would never get elected to the council. You might even lose your rating as master trader by having your citizenship voted away from you. You're not native-born, you know. What more do you think Sut can want?"
Mallow frowned stubbornly.
"So?" "My boy," said Jael, "I'll stand by you, but I can't help. You're on the spot. Dead center."
14. The council chamber was full in a very literal sense on the fourth day of the trial of Hober Mallow, master trader. The only councilman absent was feebly cursing the fractured skull that had bedridden him. The galleries were filled to the aisleways and ceilings with those few of the crowd who by influence, wealth, or sheer diabolic perseverance had managed to get in. The rest filled the square outside in swarming knots about the open-air trimensional visors. Angkor Jael made his way into the chamber with the near-futile aid and exertions of the police department, and then through the scarcely smaller confusion within to Hober Mallow's seat. Mallow turned with relief. "By Selden, you cut it thin. Have you got it?"
"Here, take it," said Jael. "It's everything you asked for."
"Good. How are they taking it outside?"
"They're wild clear through."
Jael stirred uneasily.
"I didn't want to. There's lynch talk. And Publius Manlio's men on the outer planets."
"I wanted to ask you about that, Jael. He's stirring up the hierarchy against me, is he?"
"Is he? It's the sweetest setup you ever saw. As foreign secretary, he handles the prosecution in a case of interstellar law. As high priest and primate of the church, he rouses the fanatic hordes."
"They'll forget it. Do you remember that Hardin quotation you threw at me last month? We'll show them that the atom blaster can point both ways." The mayor was taking his seat now, and the council members were rising in respect. Mallow whispered, "It's my turn today. Sit here and watch the fun." The day's proceedings began. And 15 minutes later, Hober Mallow stepped through a hostile whisper to the empty space before the mayor's bench. A lone beam of light centered upon him, and in the public visors of the city, as well as on the myriads of private visors in almost every home of the Foundation's planets, the lonely giant figure of a man stared out defiantly. He began easily and quietly. "To save time, I will admit the truth of every point made against me by the prosecution. The story of the priest and the mob, as related by them, is perfectly accurate in every detail." There was a stirring in the chamber, and a triumphant mass snarl from the gallery.
He waited patiently for silence. However, the picture they presented fell short of completion. I asked the privilege of supplying the completion in my own fashion. My story may seem irrelevant at first. I ask your indulgence for that.
Mallow made no reference to the notes before him.
I begin at the same time as the prosecution did, the day of my meetings with Geraint Sutt and Chaim Twer. What went on at those meetings, you know. The conversations have been described, and to that description I have nothing to add, except my own thoughts of that day. They were suspicious thoughts, for the events of that day were queer. Consider. Two people, neither of whom I knew more than casually, make unnatural and somewhat unbelievable propositions to me. One, the secretary to the mayor, asks me to play the part of intelligence agent to the government in a highly confidential matter, the nature and importance of which has already been explained to you. The other, self-styled leader of a political party, asks me to run for a council seat. Naturally, I looked for the ulterior motive. Sutt seemed evident. He didn't trust me. Perhaps he thought I was selling atomic power to enemies and plotting rebellion, and perhaps he was forcing the issue, or thought he was. In that case, he would need a man of his own near me on my proposed mission as a spy. The last thought, however, did not occur to me until later on, when Chaim Twer came on the scene. Consider again. Twer presents himself as a trader, retired into politics. Yet I know of no details of his trading career, although my knowledge of the field is immense. And further, although Twer boasted of a lay education, he had never heard of a Selden crisis. Obermallow waited to let the significance sink in, and was rewarded with the first silence he had yet encountered as the gallery caught its collective breath. That was for the inhabitants of Terminus itself. The men of the outer planets could hear only censored versions that would suit the requirements of religion. They would hear nothing of Selden crises. But there would be further strokes they would not miss. Mallow continued. Who here can honestly state that any man with a lay education can possibly be ignorant of the nature of a Selden crisis? There is only one type of education upon the Foundation that excludes all mention of the planned history of Selden and deals only with the man himself as a semi-mythical wizard. I knew at that instant that Chaim Twer had never been a traitor. I knew then that he was in holy orders, and perhaps a full-fledged priest. And doubtless that for the 3 years he had pretended to head the political party of the traitors, he had been a bought man of Geraint Sutt. At the moment I struck in the dark. I did not know Sutt's purposes with regard to myself, but since he seemed to be feeding me rope liberally, I handed him a few fathoms of my own. My notion was that Twer was to be with me on my voyage as unofficial guardian on behalf of Geraint Sutt. Well, if he didn't get on, I knew well there'd be other devices waiting, and those others I might not catch in time. A known enemy is relatively safe. I invited Twer to come with me. He accepted. That, gentlemen of the council, explains two things. First, it tells you that Twer is not a friend of mine testifying against me reluctantly and for conscience' sake, as the prosecution would have you believe. He is a spy, performing his paid job. Secondly, it explains a certain action of mine on the occasion of the first appearance of the priest whom I am accused of having murdered, an action as yet unmentioned, because unknown. Now there was a disturbed whispering in the council. Mallow cleared his throat theatrically and continued. I hate to describe my feelings when I first heard that we had a refugee missionary on board. I even hate to remember them. Essentially, they consisted of wild uncertainty. The event struck me at the moment as a move by Sutt, and passed beyond my comprehension or calculation. I was at sea, and completely. There was one thing I could do. I got rid of Twer for 5 minutes by sending him after my officers. In his absence, I set up a visual record receiver, so that whatever happened might be preserved for future study. This was in the hope, the wild but earnest hope, that what confused me at the time might become plain upon review. I have gone over that visual record some 50 times since. I have it here with me now, and will repeat the job a 51st time in your presence right now. The mayor pounded monotonously for order as the chamber lost its equilibrium and the gallery roared. In 5 million homes on Terminus, excited observers crowded their receiving sets more closely, and at the prosecutor's own bench, Geraint Sutt shook his head coldly at the nervous high priest, while his eyes blazed fixedly on Mallow's face. The center of the chamber was cleared, and the lights burnt low. Angkor Jeo, from his bench on the left, made the adjustments, and with a preliminary click, a scene sprang into view. In color, in 3 dimensions, in every attribute of life but life itself. There was the missionary, confused and battered, standing between the lieutenant and the sergeant. Mallow's image waited silently,
and then men filed in, Twer bringing up the rear. The conversation played itself out word for word. The sergeant was disciplined, and the missionary was questioned. The mob appeared, their growl could be heard, and the revered George Parma made his wild appeal. Mallow drew his gun, and the missionary, as he was dragged away, lifted his arms in a mad final curse, and a tiny flash of light came and went. The scene ended, with the officers frozen at the horror of the situation, while Twer clamped shaking hands over his ears and Mallow calmly put his gun away. The lights were on again. The empty space in the center of the floor was no longer even apparently full. Mallow, the real Mallow of the present, took up the burden of his narration. The incident, you see, is exactly as the prosecution has presented it, on the surface. I'll explain that shortly. Chaim Twer's emotions through the whole business shows clearly a priestly education, by the way. It was on that same day that I pointed out certain incongruities in the episode to Twer. I asked him where the missionary came from in the midst of the near-desolate tract we occupied at the time. I asked further where the gigantic mob had come from, with the nearest sizable town 100 miles away. The prosecution has paid no attention to such problems. Or to other points. For instance, the curious point of George Palmer's blatant conspicuousness. A missionary on Corel, risking his life in defiance of both Corellian and Foundation law, parades about in a very new and very distinctive priestly costume. There's something wrong there. At the time, I suggested that the missionary was an unwitting accomplice of the Condor, who was using him in an attempt to force us into an act of wildly illegal aggression to justify in law his subsequent destruction of our ship and of us. The prosecution has anticipated this justification of my actions. They have expected me to explain that the safety of my ship, my crew, my mission itself were at stake and could not be sacrificed for one man when that man would in any case have been destroyed, with us or without us. They reply by muttering about the Foundation's honor and the necessity of upholding our dignity in order to maintain our ascendancy. For some strange reason, however, the prosecution has neglected George Parma himself as an individual. They brought out no details concerning him, neither his birthplace, nor his education, nor any detail of previous history. The explanation of this will also explain the incongruities I have pointed out in the visual record you have just seen. The two are connected. The prosecution has advanced no details concerning George Parma, because it cannot. That scene you saw by visual record seemed phony because George Parma was phony. There never was a George Parma. This whole trial is the biggest farce ever cooked up over an issue that never existed. Once more, he had to wait for the babble to die down. He said slowly, I'm going to show you the enlargement of a single still from the visual record. It will speak for itself. Lights again, Jail. The chamber dimmed, and the empty air filled again with frozen figures in ghostly waxen illusion. The officers of the Far Star struck their stiff, impossible attitudes. A gun pointed from Mallow's rigid hand. At his left, the revered George Parma, caught in mid-shriek, stretched his claws upward while the falling sleeves hung halfway. And from the missionary's hand there was that little gleam that in the previous showing had flashed and gone. It was a permanent glow now. Keep your eye on that light on his hand, called Mallow from the shadows. Enlarge that scene, Jail. The tableau bloated quickly. Outer portions fell away as the missionary drew towards the center and became a giant. Then there was only a head and an arm, and then only a hand, which filled everything and remained there in immense, hazy tautness. The light had become a set of fuzzy, glowing letters. K.S.P. That, Mallow's voice boomed out, is a sample of tattooing, gentlemen. Under ordinary light, it is invisible. But under ultraviolet light, with which I flooded the room in taking this visual record, it stands out in high relief. I'll admit, it is a naive method of secret identification, but it works on Corel, where UV light is not to be found on street corners. Even in our ship, detection was accidental. Perhaps some of you have already guessed what KSP stands for. George Parma knew his priestly lingo well and did his job magnificently. Where he had learned it and how, I cannot say. But KSP stands for Corellian Secret Police. Mallow shouted over the tumult, roaring against the noise. I have collateral proof in the form of documents brought from Corel, which I can present to the council if required. And where is now the prosecution's case?
They have already made and remade the monstrous suggestion that I should have fought for the missionary in defiance of the law and sacrificed my mission, my ship, and myself to the honor of the Foundation. But to do it for an impostor? Should I have done it then for a Corellian secret agent tricked out in the robes and verbal gymnastics probably borrowed of an Anacreonian exile? Would Geraint Sutt and Publius Manlio have had me fall into a stupid, odious trap? His hoarse voice faded into the featureless background of a shouting mob. He was being lifted onto shoulders and carried to the mayor's bench. Out the windows, he could see a torrent of madmen swarming into the square to add to the thousands there already. Mallow looked about for Angkor Jail, but it was impossible to find any single face in the incoherence of the mass. Slowly, he became aware of a rhythmic, repeated shout that was spreading from a small beginning and pulsing into insanity. Long live Mallow! Long live Mallow! Long live Mallow! 15. Angkor Jail blinked at Mallow out of a haggard face. The last 2 days had been mad, sleepless ones. Mallow, you've put on a beautiful show, so don't spoil it by jumping too high. You can't seriously consider running for mayor. Mob enthusiasm is a powerful thing, but it's notoriously fickle. Exactly, said Mallow grimly. So we must coddle it, and the best way to do that is to continue the show. Now what? You're to have Publius Manlio and Geraint Sutt arrested. What? Just what you hear. Have the mayor arrest them. I don't care what threats you use. I control the mob, for today, at any rate. He won't dare face them. Not on what charge, man? On the obvious one. They've been inciting the priesthood of the outer planets to take sides in the factional quarrels of the Foundation. That's illegal, by Selden. Charge them with endangering the state. And I don't care about a conviction any more than they did in my case. Just get them out of circulation until I'm mayor. It's half a year till election. Not too long. Mallow was on his feet, and his sudden grip of Jail's arm was tight. Listen, I'd seize the government by force if I had to, the way Salvor Hardin did 100 years ago. There's still that Selden crisis coming up, and when it comes, I have to be mayor and high priest, both. Jail's brow furrowed. He said quietly, What's it going to be? Corell, after all? Mallow nodded. Of course. They'll declare war eventually, though I'm betting it'll take another pair of years. With atomic ships? What do you think? Those 3 merchant ships we lost in their space sector weren't knocked over with compressed air pistols. Jail, they're getting ships from the Empire itself. Don't open your mouth like a fool. I said the Empire. It's still there, you know. It may be gone here in the periphery, but in the galactic center, it's still very much alive. And one false move means that it itself may be on our neck. That's why I must be mayor and high priest. I'm the only man who knows how to fight the crisis. Jail swallowed dryly. How? What are you going to do? Nothing. Jail smiled uncertainly. Really? All of that? But Mallow's answer was incisive. When I'm boss of this foundation, I'm going to do nothing. 100% of nothing. And that is the secret of this crisis. 16. Asper Argo, the well-beloved Commodore of the Corellian Republic, greeted his wife's entry by a hangdog lowering of his scanty eyebrows. To her, at least, his self-adopted epithet did not apply. Even he knew that. She said, in a voice as sleek as her hair and as cold as her eyes, My gracious lord, I understand, has finally come to a decision upon the fate of the Foundation upstarts. Indeed, said the Commodore sourly, and what more does your versatile understanding embrace? Enough, my very noble husband. You had another of your vacillating consultations with your counselors. Fine advisers, with infinite scorn. A herd of palsied, purblind idiots hugging their sterile prophets close to their sunken chests in the face of my father's displeasure. And who, my dear, was the mild response, is the excellent source from which your understanding understands all this? The Condora laughed shortly. If I told you, my source would be more corpse than source. Well, you'll have your own way, as always. The Commodore shrugged and turned away. And as for your father's displeasure, I much fear me it extends to a niggardly refusal to supply more ships.
More ships? She blazed away hotly. And haven't you 5? Don't deny it. I know you have 5, and a 6th is promised.
Promised for the last year.
But 1, just 1, can blast that foundation into stinking rubble. Just 1 to sweep their little pygmy boats out of space.
I couldn't attack their planet even with 12.
And how long would their planet hold out with their trade ruined and their cargoes of toys and trash destroyed?
Those toys and trash mean money, he sighed. A good deal of money.
But if you had the foundation itself, would you not have all it contained? And if you had my father's respect and gratitude, would you not have more than ever the foundation could give you? It's been 3 years, more, since that barbarian came with his magic sideshow. It's long enough.